This is my story. I was an 18-year-old high school graduate faced with a major decision: wait to be drafted in the Army or enlist in the Navy. I chose Navy. September 1st, 43, I was inducted into the United States Naval Reserves in Indianapolis, Indiana. September 8th, I arrived at Great Lakes Training Center in Chicago and began boot training along with 74 other apprentice seamen. I don't remember too much about boot camp, except that I wore out a good pair of my own shoes. The Navy couldn't fit me. 13.5B, you know. It was late November when boot training, I found out just how cold it can be off Lake Michigan. Naval Hospital Corps School training started November 27th, 43. This was an accelerated program, as many corpsmen were needed at once. Very strict about revealing any future orders. Graduated from Corps School January 7th, 1944, and promoted to HA1C. Left next day for Naval Hospital, Newport, Rhode Island, part of a blanket draft of 500 Naval corpsmen heading to East Coast. I caught temporary duty nights in a combination ward of gonorrhea and surveyitis. Patients, one of whom I'll never forget. I was ready for anything after 3 weeks in the nut house. Left Newport January 29th, 1944 for Lido Beach, New York, and temporary duty with the Seabees. I thought Great Lakes was cold, but I'll tell you right now, the Atlantic Ocean had them beat. So we set targets for the Seabees. For about a month, on and off, and then we were transferred to LST medical crews, and I was assigned to a temporary assignment to go overseas with LST 505. Well, LST 505 was a brand new LST with the LCVP, still cabled topside. That's another landing craft vehicle, large, and it's transported on an LST to the war zone, and then it's launched from the LST to serve in a landing craft operation. I was then assigned to, let's see, I gotta get my bearings here. I was then assigned to LST 375 on, Chattanooga Naval Base, that's not the one. Well, anyway, I was transferred to LST 375. And we made three trips across the English Channel. And this date was from April or February 29th. Yeah, February 29th, 1944 through June 21st, 1944. And the trips, of course, were made after June 5th because, or June 6th as it happened, but it was scheduled originally June 5th, and that was the landing at Normandy. And so I made Cherbourg Peninsula on June 6th, 1944. And we operated from England in a convoy of LSTs loaded with heavy equipment, tanks, big guns, 105s, anything that would roll on wheels, we had aboard the tank deck of the LST. And the job was to plan it with the tide. The tide would go out And here we sat on the beach with the LSD high and dry, no water. That's when they opened the bow doors and rolled out the big stuff. Of course, the assault troops had gone in quite a bit earlier than the first run that we made, so we took on wounded. And of course, I had made friends with this young guy from Bossy of Evansville, being from Kokomo, and I got word from home. This was in June. This was early in June, about the 1st or 2nd of June. We got mail in England before joining the convoy, and it came down to the fact that Bossy of Evansville and Kokomo had come down to the final game of the Indiana State Tournament, and Bossy won it by 1 point, 33-32. And of course, this kid was tickled to death, you know. He was a Bossy graduate, and he was part of the Army Ranger crew that we had aboard. One of the details that I'd like to describe was the actual arrival at the Normandy beachhead at around 2 o'clock in the morning or 2:30 on June the 6th. Well, the Germans had set up these rocket jabbies all the way around the beach area, and the beach was full of big chunks of cement and iron railings and just anything you can find that would trash up the beach, making it hard for a landing to occur. Well, the Rangers that we had aboard were a demolition squad. Their job was to go in there on a rhino, and I'll explain what a rhino was, and dynamite this bridge, this trash out of the way, so the LSDs could get on in there with troops and equipment. Well, of course, this rhino was nothing but a huge metal floating dock powered by all things a Kiekever Corporation outboard, which was later known and is known today as Mercury Outboards. And it was a 40 horse. It moved the large metal dockage on which the troops were standing very slowly towards the beach. Well, of course, as soon as the Luftwaffe found out that that was going on, they came in with the fighter planes, and they would fire tracers until it bounced off the deck of the Rhino, and then they knew they were hitting a target, so then they'd swoop down and come back up. Well, of course, all the guys had gotten off and got under the thing until the air raid was over, and then they proceeded on their way to do the job that they had to do. But we took wounded on from the landing using a tank deck as a hospital. And some of them, of course, were German prisoners, and some of them were, of course, our guys. Well, wouldn't you know, I took on this young kid from Bossy of Evansville, and he'd been hit by a sniper, and it went right through his neck and came out the other side clean as a whistle. It didn't do anything but give him a sore throat. It missed his esophagus, it missed his major arteries, it slipped through there somehow and missed his spinal column and came out the other side. He had a Band-Aid on the front side and a Band-Aid on the back side, and that's all he had. And of course, what we did was to dress it. And he gave me a sea jacket back in the early days when he first boarded our LST, which was 375. And he gave me a sea jacket because he said he couldn't carry it, didn't need it, and I'd be welcome to have it. I would probably be able to use it because it was cool. But I tried to give it back to him when we took him back aboard, figuring that he might need it in England, you know. He's going to go to a base hospital in England and then from there on home. Yeah, the war was over as far as he was concerned. But he wouldn't take it. So we said our goodbyes when we got back to England. On the second trip back across the channel with wounded, we had taken troops and more troops and more heavy gear, and then started back on our second trip in a convoy. 376 was hit by a U-boat torpedo in a convoy, and we picked up survivors from that explosion. The LST did not sink. As far as I know, it hobbled on in. It was dark. I couldn't see a whole lot, but we were taking the survivors aboard from 376. And I've seen since then, I've seen pictures of that on television of the U-boats darting in and out of our convoys back with wounded, which was against the Geneva description of what's to be done with ships being used as a hospital ship, which we were. We had their own German prisoners aboard that had been badly wounded too, some of whom died before we got back over and across, because the channel crossing usually took somewhere around 8 hours or more in the confines of but what I'm trying to say is, we traveled in a group. The convoy was slow because they zigzagged across the channel to avoid contact with any more U-boats. The third trip was uneventful, except that we took aboard a German prisoner, and he wasn't anything but a torso. His arms and legs had been blown off by a landmine, and probably was a German landmine, because we didn't have them in there. We didn't have time to set them. But anyway, as far as I know, I think he survived. He was semi-conscious, and the bleeding was under control from the field hospital. But anyway, we got back, and I went I can't think of the name of the English British town where the convoy formed right now, but the advancement in Cherbourg Peninsula, of which I'm credited of taking part in, was over, and they had gone beyond the German 88s and the rocketry, and were liberating parts of France every day by this time. And then we were ordered off of the LSTs, and I rode a bus to Rosnes, Scotland. And then Rosnes, Scotland was a receiving center where you waited to be shipped back to the United States. And so I believe it was June, the latter part of June, June 29th, yes it was. I was landed at the Boston Navy Yard in the States, back in the States. From there, I had a 30-day leave, and my folks were living in Findlay, Ohio at the time. My father was working for WFIN radio station as a sales director, and it was good to get home for the 30 days. Unfortunately, I had orders to report to Camp Lejeune, North Carolina, and the Fleet Marine Force. In other words, I had been assigned to the Marine Corps, to the 34th Replacement Battalion, and right there, I'm going to take a little break and see how we are recording, and then we'll get right back to the story of what happens to HA1C DK Jeffrey as he enters boot camp in Camp Lejeune, North Carolina, Bulldog Marine Camp. At this point, I'm going to digress just a bit and go back to some of the funny things that occurred. The first one was when I was transported to Lido Beach. waiting to join the LSD medical groups, I was assigned to a shack, a clap shack, we call it at the time there. There's people suffering from gonorrhea and what have you. And one of the things that happened, the third night I was there in this glass house in the middle of this ward, by myself, of course, and I'm really worried about me. I'm not worried about them. I was just agreeing that I didn't know what was going on at all. But anyway, there was a lot of commotion down the aisle. I went out to see what it was, and this guy was on the floor having an epileptic fit. And all of a sudden, this long, lanky guy came out of nowhere, landed on top of this guy, and said, "Get me a tongue blade." Well, I rushed in and had a bottle of tongue blades there. I got him a tongue blade, and he popped that guy's jaw down and flopped that tongue out and saved the guy's life. I mean, that was just all there was to it. He just saved the guy's life. And come to find out, he was there and had malaria, and he'd come from Guadalcanal, and he was going to be discharged. As soon as he was well, he would go back down to a receiving station, probably 29 Palms or somewhere where he could be discharged because his service was over. That was one of the anecdotes. The other was when we boarded this LST 505 in Pier 92, New York, and headed out, we had a brand new crew and a brand new skipper. The skipper was only a Lieutenant J.G. Well, we hit this terrible storm out on the East Coast, one of the worst they'd ever had. The waves were in the 25-foot class, and it was just miserable aboard that LSD. Everyone was sick. The ship split down the middle, but it split at the heads on both sides. That's the bathrooms on both sides of the ship, and those hatches were dogged down, and the bathrooms were allowed to fill up, because we couldn't do anything else, but it didn't affect the safety of the LST at all. They're very tough that way because they're a lot like a submarine. You can dog down all these different compartments. But anyway, we pulled into Boston Navy Yard from Pier 92 on up the coast to Boston Navy Yard, and we hobbled in there, and that ship was such a mess of vomit, and all the troops were sick, all the crew was sick, the skipper himself was sick. And we got into this thing, and they put the 505 in dry dock until they could clean that ship up and repair the damage where it had actually split. And that took 9 days. Well, what I'm trying to get at is we had liberty to go into Boston, and I went in with Mike Hopkins and Robbie Ingram to buy a watch. And we got to this jewelry store, and everybody agreed that this Benrus watch, or Bulova watch, that I had picked out was a good buy at $32. So I paid him $32, and we went out and decided that we would take in a show, a movie. So we're sitting in the movie, and I look down at my new watch, and it's not quite the right time according to a clock that's mounted on the wall up beside the screen in the movie house. So I decide to set my watch in, and lo and behold, I pull the stem clear out of the watch. Mike Hopkins says, "I can fix that all right." He says, "Just for now, just push that curve back in there." I pushed the curb back in there, and it didn't run, but anyway, it was together till we got back on board ship. As time would have it, we shipped out with that ship the next day, headed in a convoy, of course, to Milford Haven, Wales. And in the mess hall, we put a blanket over the things, usually to play cards, but this time, we put the blanket over the tables in order for Mike to work on my Bulova watch. Well, as the time would have it, I wound up with a box of springs and sprockets and everything. The watch was an absolutely total mess, total loss. The parts weren't probably all there, Anyway, I got it all together and put it in the box. And Ingram says to me, he says, you probably can sell that in Wales. Well, we got it. Liberty one evening, towards evening, 4 o'clock to 10 or 11 or something like that. Anyway, we got in and found this jeweler, and he was just thrilled to death over that. So he offered me something like 6 or 10 pounds, I guess. He offered me around 10 pounds. I thought, 10 bucks? No way. I just got through paying 32 for that. Ingram poked me, says, each one of those is almost worth $5. So it wound up, it wound up in $70, I forget just what it was, $70 that I sold this jeweler the watch. He didn't have a new watch in the whole place. He's probably tickled to death to get it. And that was one story. What was the other story?
And he told about the sickness on the ship and all that, but that was three stories,
I think. The next thing that actually happened, it was a pretty serious business, but I was assigned the 29th of February to Foxy 29 for duty with LST medical crews. And on April 29th, I was transferred as ship's company to USS LST 375. And of course, we were there when the crew came off of 375, and they looked like they'd seen ghosts. The reason was that a 500-pound bomb had stuck directly in the fantail of the ship and failed to explode, and they had to travel I don't know how long in order to get a demolition crew together that could defuse that bomb, never knowing whether the thing could go off at any minute, you know. And a 500 pounder would have blown the whole back end of the ship right out. That's all there would have been to it. It just sunk. But anyway, they got it repaired, and they had a lot of people that were very nearly a nervous breakdown who left the ship to go home. Yeah, that was on April 29th, 1944, and we became ship's company on 375. And from that point on, we've been over that story. So now we are back home in the States in order to take a 30-day leave in Findlay, Ohio. And then I reported back to the 3rd Medical Battalion, 3rd Marine Division, Fleet Marine Force in the field at Camp Lejeune, North Carolina. And there I joined the 34th Replacement Battalion in boot camp. From that point, that was January 1st, 1945, and then I was shipped with the 34th replacement draft to Little Tokyo in San Diego. And let's see where we went. I'll have to check it out here a little bit. One other thing that I'd like to mention is getting back from England to the United States. Actually, this was from Rosneath, Scotland, where we left from. Coming home, I was aboard a USS United States, a luxury liner converted to a troop ship,
And I was on the chow line serving over 3,000 prisoners twice a day. And they were in the lowest hold and doing young right. They were doing just fine. They were really old men and young kids. And of course, we always chatted with them, and they were something else. You could trade a button here, or, you know, an insignia there, or whatever. And they were really pretty nice people, most of them. Just thought I'd insert that. And we're back home, and we're at Camp Lejeune, and we're through at Camp Lejeune. And we're headed for Camp Elliott, San Diego, which we call Little Tokyo. And we arrived there on 11/8/85. No, that isn't right. That isn't right. Let's see, where did we get that? Well, at any rate, I was with the 3rd Medical Battalion, 3rd Marine Division, Fleet Marine Force in the field. And we hit San Diego, Little Tokyo base, during a rainy season, and it rained so hard for 30 days the entire time that no one had any dry gear. Not one thing was dry. So we packed it all in and traveled up the coast to San Francisco. And there, we boarded the USS Rochambeau, which was an old French luxury liner converted to a troop ship. And we sailed for Guam. The entire 34th Replacement Battalion. And to make a long story short, we were 56 days going from San Francisco Bay to Guam. We stopped one time, got off at Aniwetok, a little dot of an island, and had a few beers and a softball game, as I recall. And that was the only time we got off the ship, and I slept topside for almost every night. It was just like a South Seas cruise. It was unbelievable. Warm and dry. Boy, we had everything dried, I'll tell you, by the time we were 2 weeks out. Everybody was dry and pretty happy about the situation. Anyway, we arrived at Guam, and I spent quite a bit of time at Guam. And during that time, the island had been blitzed by the 4th Assault Battalion of Marines, and they'd left a lot of anguished poor farmers out there who were Japanese soldiers, all right, but they didn't know the anything that was happening. They had no artillery, no firepower at all. There wasn't anything they could do but live like animals in the jungle. And of course, the Marines had to have hunting parties, go out every weekend. That was a hobby. And it required that a corpsman go with them. And I went one time, but I didn't care for it. So it wasn't my idea of hunting down these poor souls. Didn't even know. You hear them rattling the garbage cans at night and stuff like that because they didn't have any food. They didn't have anything. But believe it or not, it was 1954. I had been through dental school. Phyllis and I had established our practice in Garrick. I'd been there for 3 years. And the news came over the television that the last Japanese soldiers had finally surrendered on Guam, to show you that what these poor souls had been through. Of course, the Marines were famous for not taking any prisoners. They just shot them when they found them. When they caught up with them, they'd kill them. But anyway, let's see, I'm going to stop there and get organized again. I enjoyed the service on Guam. We had a lot of fun. All of the tents were strong back. That is, they had been
furnished with a wooden floor that we scratched up the lumber out from the gooks or from the natives, and strong backed the tents. And it made things a lot better. Fewer rats inside the tents and a lot of snakes and whatnot like that didn't get in quite as easily as they were, as they did before. However, I had a pet goat at the time, and she would follow me around till I would go to work or go down to play volleyball or whatever. We had a volleyball team we were pretty proud of. But anyway, this nanny goat was a mess. She'd go in our strong back tent, find my bunk and curl up in it, go sound asleep. And then sometimes she'd leave me a little calling card about 10 or 15 marbles in the middle of my bunk. And everybody in there was complaining about that goat stinking. So I had to take her outside and kind of keep her out of the tent, which she did all right. But she loved the K-ration biscuits. And of course, we were on C rations then, which was pretty good eating, I'll tell you. But we still had quite a few packages of K rations around. Everybody had one. She loved those K ration biscuits. And boy, she just begged, you know. But she was the cutest thing you ever did see, white nanny goat. And she'd get on top of her little shed and see me coming, and she'd begin to buck. And then she'd run towards me just a bucking, you know. All she wanted was her head rubbed. And she was quite a pet. Anyway, Guam was pretty nice, and he had a lot of fun there. And then the fun came to an end when we were called upon to be D plus two or plus one standby for Iwo Jima. And of course we left after getting organized there on Guam as to your squad and what you were to do, and we boarded the LST again, I don't even remember the number of this one, and headed for Iwo Jima in a convoy, of course. And they had been softening up the islands with the big guns, the naval. They had battle wagons there and destroyer escorts. I don't think there are any destroyers there yet, but they came shortly after we got there. We went ashore on D plus two on Evil and went right directly to our assigned objective and dug in right there and didn't have any trouble at all. There was nothing to it because this top kick, all I can remember is Bernie. But anyway, it doesn't make any difference what his name was. He was good at what he did, and he knew how to stay out of trouble. And that's what we did. We stayed out of trouble. So anyway, shortly thereafter, the island was secured. It really wasn't shortly, I guess, because a lot of men tried to get ashore there that didn't get ashore. It depended on where you were, how much climbing you had to do. The place stunk of sulfur. I don't know. That's about all I remember about it. I was pretty excited. Hopefully, the time would pass in a hurry, and it did. And then we moved on from there to Okinawa. We stopped at Saipan. We had dysentery aboard. Some of the guys were sick, and some we had wounded aboard also from Evil. But anyway, we landed at Okinawa, and there I was assigned to the anti-aircraft battalion. Forget which. I don't remember the number of it. Oh, it was this transfer state to 2nd Anti-Aircraft Artillery Battalion. And that was the 27th of January, 1945.
Let me see.
I'm trying to get some of these dates. Anyway, we stayed on Okinawa for, that was our rest camp around the Yantan airstrip. It was attached to the 2nd Aircraft Battalion. And we had Navy gull wing fighter squad was in there. And one of the pilots was a kid from home, Dick Reinick. And he asked me one day, he says, they're decommissioning my ship, taking the, he had a reconnaissance plane that he flew, and they're taking the camera equipment out. He says, I'm going to ring it out, or I'm going to take it up. He says, if you want to ride, I'll be going over Iwo Jima, another small island, where Ernie Pyle had been killed earlier, and where I'd lost some friends, too. And he says, I'll take you over Iwo Jima. I says, yeah, that'd be great, you know. I'd never been up in a plane in all my life. So one day I went over there to the strip, and he packed me in there around Kapok jackets on my face, and my face facing the photography glass plate in the bottom of the craft. And my, what a ride. He flew straight up, he flew straight down, he flew sideways, he flew upside down. I told him, I said, if I wasn't so doggone sick, I'd kill you, you know. But actually, it was a pretty good time. And a funny thing happened, that next night, or two nights later, he ran like a scared rabbit away from us, looking for a cave. Because they were having an air raid, and the Japs were dropping paratroopers, they were told. he couldn't get his plane in the air because he didn't have any guns or any armor or anything else. All he could do was run. And it serves you right for making me so sick. Anyway, we took him in and played cards in a cave that night. They never got over us. This Cracker Jack outfit, these gull wing fighters, forget what they're calling it, Corsairs, this Corsair squadron was deadly. Boy, they'd take these Japanese Bettys and just absolutely shoot them down. That's all there was to it. They never got over us. But that was part of the excitement. We had something like 300 and some odd air raids on Okinawa. I would say that probably 50 of those air raids were after the Japanese had surrendered. They didn't get the word out to them, to wherever they were coming from. And we had air raid after air raid, long after the night that the war actually officially ended, according to the word we received. Why these guys pulled these 10, I forget what they were, 50 millimeter cannons straight up in the air, shooting them straight up in the air, and one guy was killed in the area from fallout from celebration. Anyway, that ended right shortly. Yeah, they didn't permit that. And the rest of the time, we spent in rejoicing that the war was officially over. And then along came my time to go home. And I was to embark on board the USS Meriwether from Okinawa, and we had a pretty good ride home. It was pretty quick considering how much time we'd spent getting there. I think we were on, let's see, 22nd of October, and that was then November the 8th, 1945, we arrived at San Diego, California.
Thank you, Gary.
And then I traveled up the coast to
Bremerton in Washington, where I was discharged from the Navy and caught a train home. And that is the end of my story. And if I think of any other anecdotes that might be interesting to you, I will certainly add them to the tape. Thanks for listening. Bye. Just a little story to leave you laughing. I was home on leave, on a 30-day leave, and I was an old salt, you know, having been overseas with the Navy and made Normandy. And I'm walking down the streets of Findlay, Ohio, and in this storefront, a man in khaki uniform goes, "Hey, buddy, hey, buddy." And I walked over to him, and he says, "I got this razor, and I got to sell it. And it's a genuine chick, and I got to sell it for $8, because I need that money." I said, "You wait right here." And I ran all the way back to the folks' apartment, got my $8, ran down and gave him the $8, and he gave me the razor. And I took it home with me up to the apartment to try it out, because I hadn't shaved that day yet. And I plugged her in, and oh, it just sounded great and everything, you know. And I kept rubbing my face with it and rubbing my face with it, and nothing was happening, wouldn't cut hot butter. And I finally got to looking at it, and inside this cellophane wrapper was a doggone jobby that said "genuine chick," and then down underneath it in real fine print, it said "patterned after." Well, needless to say, I ran back down on the street trying to find that guy that hooked me for $8. I never found him. He moved on. But I learned one thing. I don't buy anything with "stay buddy." Well, anyway, the rank I left the service with was a pharmacist mate, third class, and I spent 8 months with the United States Navy and 2 years with the United States Marine Corps, attached to the United States Marine Corps. And now I'm going to change tapes. In 1994, which was the 50th anniversary of the invasion of Normandy Beachhead in France and the beginning of the freeing of the country of France, we were able to return to Normandy for this anniversary celebration, thanks to Chuck and Callista, and they flew over, we flew over with them. And it was just a wonderful thing to return to. I wouldn't have recognized much of it from what I had seen during the war, but it was a beautiful anniversary celebration, and we enjoyed every moment of it. The problem was that we started trying to get a passport for me. To fly to France, and we were just unable to do it. After all, I had military service and all ball of wax. My birth certificate was alleged to have been born, not an official birth certificate. So we had to get old school pictures from Bluffton and people to write and say, yes, he was in a class in grade school in Bluffton, and so forth and so on. And it just got to be a heck of a note. And thanks to Richard Agar Brickley, MD, in Indianapolis, who was a grade school friend of mine and in my class, or I was in his class, and he helped immensely in getting it. And we had another one, a TV station over here, that went to bat for us, and pretty soon we got the job done. Thanks to Mother, who did everything she could do to get that birth certificate. It took about 4 months.
to get the passport. And then again in 2001 on Veterans Day, I received a medal from Congressman Porter Goss of Florida, and it was the Jubilee Medal given to anyone who participated in the liberation of France or who landed at Utah Beach or Omaha Beach. And of course, Cherbourg Peninsula is part of it. And so I was very pleased and honored to receive the medal from Congressman Porter Goss. And at the request of my children and grandchildren, this is recorded July 18th, 2002 in Naples, Florida. Hope we haven't bored you too much. Bye-bye, Dad.